You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to a very special episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. This is our annual Christmas episode, and on the other end are Mega.
Hello, good morning.
And Matt.
Ho ho ho.
So this time we're going to do something completely different. We've all brought some movies, but this time it's a surprise to everyone else what movies we all brought each other. So Christmas, hooray. What are your plans going to be, guys, for the big X?
I mean, there's definitely going to be some food involved, possibly some presents. But in terms of culture, we will have to go and see the final Star Wars film, obviously. From everything I've heard, I've definitely adjusted my expectations. It sounds like it's more The Force Awakens than The Last Jedi, which for some people is cause for celebration, for others less so. Other than that, I finally want to catch up with that Irishman. You know, what better film to watch at Christmas than a 3-hour Scorsese CGI fest? What about you, Maga?
Oh, that's pretty basic. It's the same thing every year. On the 24th, we go to my partner's family to the south of here. And on the 25th, we're going to my family to the north of here. So it sounds like a lot of travel. It's not. It's just visiting two families. Maybe I'm going to see Star Wars with my daughter as well, but that's really up to her. I haven't seen her until yesterday. She's not at home right now. So yeah, it's just it's basically family time.
Yeah, same here as well. We have a lot of family stuff going on. We go boating each year for one half a day. So that's on the menu. In-laws, I have my birthday. Very inconveniently between Christmas and New Year, which is a little bit annoying. We wanted to get out for a bit to Antwerp, which we also try to do as often as we can. And otherwise I'm trying to read a book or something, you know, take some quiet time, have some time for myself. And of course, lots and lots and lots of food. I'm planning to stuff my face. That's what Christmas is for.
Absolutely. Not just a damn good cup, but a damn good plate as well. Or many of them.
Yep. So in the intro, I talked a bit about the surprise aspect of this podcast. So let's jump right in. Matt, what did you bring us?
Okay, you said movies and I didn't bring a movie. I can talk about movies. I can probably pull 3 movies out of my hat and just bullshit about them. Do we bleep that out? Probably not. It's Christmas. What I brought is actually a computer game. On the blog, I sometimes write about computer games. I think of the regulars who contribute to the blog, I'm the only one who's a big gamer. I've been playing computer games since the early 80s, which dates me. And I think it is an absolutely fascinating medium. It's also an absolutely frustrating medium. But over the last couple of years, I think it's matured in some weird and wonderful ways. And that's why I thought as a Christmas present to the two of you, I would bring a game called Disco Elysium. I have blogged about it, but I think there's so much to say about it. I could probably bore you for 5 hours about it, but everything I've got is on 2 pages written down, so it's probably not going to be those 5 hours. Let me perhaps just first ask the two of you, what are your experiences with computer games? Do you ever play video games? Have you played a lot of them? Do you just know Tetris and Super Mario and that's it?
I'm going to out myself on this podcast. This is the first time. I did play video games in the past. I played things like PS4, Little Big Planet, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Currently, I play both Pokemon Go and Harry Potter Wizards Unite. So I'm out of the closet now. This is the truth.
Well, it's nothing to be ashamed about. I mean, I'm not much of a player. 3 out of 4 games I've played because someone present right now recommended them to me. Hello, Matt. There are others that I started playing because my daughter Lea was interested in them. For instance, Lego Star Wars and Lego Harry Potter. I did my bit of Just Dance when you have to sort of dance in front of the screen. Yeah, so now I'm out of the closet too. Other than that, I've played inordinate amount of the very early Donkey Kong game, where Mario has to sort of save the princess from the big ape. I'm not bad at pinball. Does that count? And finally, I have a very, very unhealthy addiction to Alien Isolation. It's horrible. I have to play that one at least once a year.
For Christmas.
Not necessarily for Christmas. It's just, you know, between other projects, I go and play some. That's it.
I think that's very healthy. Disco Elysium, it is a role-playing game. And when people hear role-playing games, most people, I think, would think of Dungeons and Dragons. They would think of orcs and elves. And I don't know, Longsword plus two against undead. Possibly they might think of Warcraft, World of Warcraft. Now, Disco Elysium, already the title, I think, gives you different associations. The original title was No Truce with the Furies, which I thought was a great title, but everyone kept reading it as No Truce with the Furries. And I think that's why they changed the title. So if it's not Dungeons and Dragons, if it's not high fantasy, what is it? I think it's the illegitimate bastard offspring of something like Life on Mars, not the song, but the TV series, and China Miéville's The City and the City. It's set in a kind of not quite our world, but you can recognize bits and pieces of it. The aesthetic is grungy. It's post-communist, post-socialist. There's this 70s color scheme that should not be beautiful, but weirdly is. There's touches of painters like Francis Bacon or Otto Dix, the German, I think he was a caricaturist and painter from the 20s or so. It's set in this place called Revachol, which is the disgraced former capital of basically this country, divided into zones of control under foreign occupation. Half a century ago, there was a world revolution that failed. Basically, outside powers decided, okay, they got rid of the king. We're happy with that. But they want communism, we're much less happy with that. I mean, that's just not good for business. So outside forces, USA, they're not called that, but it's that kind of thing, come in, defeat the revolutionaries, and impose a kind of peace. The place is filled with former loyalists to the king, with former communists and anarchists. It's filled with people who have profited from the situation and people who have suffered. It's basically a country still riven by the wounds of revolution and war, and it's an in-between world. In that respect, it's very China Miéville. It's a world of frustrated ideologies, wasted opportunities. It's a world of what could have beens. And what kind of a role-playing game can you tell in a world like that? Obviously, you're going to tell a murder mystery. So in this game, you wake up. You have no idea who you are. That's pretty much a role-playing game trope, amnesia, but the game does it really uniquely. It's basically the different parts of your body and psyche interact with each other. They talk to each other. And the first thing you see in the game is, in text, your ancient reptilian brain, that's what it's called, talks. It says, there is nothing, only warm primordial blackness. Your conscience ferments in it, no larger than a single grain of malt. You don't have to do anything anymore, ever. It's slightly purple writing, but it's very self-conscious. It knows what it is, and it makes fun of it. And then you're given the choice to either simply keep on non-existing. You could do this forever and ever and ever, and that could be your game. Or you could talk back at your ancient reptile brain. So you say, never, ever, ever. And your ancient reptilian brain answers, never, ever, 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 baby. So that's where the disco comes in. But as time passes, suddenly thoughts of ex-wives pop in, and you get all these tropes from, you know, from film noir. And even though you don't know who you are yet, you already get this impression that you might be a detective. You have ex-wives, you have regrets, you drink hard, and that's possibly because why you don't remember anything. You're someone who's compromised and tainted with all kinds of corruption, and a part of you actually enjoys that. So you wake up. You find yourself mostly naked in a hotel room that's completely trashed. Most likely you've trashed it. You're just standing there in your underpants, who have seen better days, much better days, and your socks. You've got this handlebar moustache. You've got long hair. Your tie is stuck to the ceiling fan. And you can, as your first action, try to get your tie down from the ceiling fan. I tried that. It was too much for me. I was still too hungover. I died of a heart attack. Game over. Start again. The game is full of such situations. And I think your first reaction to it is, it's weird, it's surreal, it's funny, it's perhaps a bit full of itself, but in a cool way. And it is all of these things. But it also becomes strangely poignant. It becomes political, but not in a kind of sloganeering way. Because you're an amnesiac, you can basically shape your own character. You've got different skills like logic, rhetoric, conceptualization, which help with the cop stuff. But you've got much more interesting skills like drama, empathy, shivers, Inland Empire, which already tells you something about the kind of thought world we're in. And all of that, I mean, you basically finding your shoe that you threw out of the window in a drunken rage, getting down your tie, if you're good enough, discovering your face in the mirror and discovering the horrible smirk that's etched into it. Basically, you've got something called the expression, capital E. You're the kind of guy who thinks he's cool, he's sexy, and everyone else who looks at him just goes, no, put that face away, please. And then you realize there's a dead, bloated body hanging from a tree in the backyard. You're a cop. You've been sent there to find out why this happened. That's where basically the story starts. There's murder mystery. That's also a mystery about who are you. You slowly, with the character, discover the world. You discover what's happened, what's going to happen. And you're a failure. You're a complete failure. And I love that. Computer games, in most cases, are power fantasies. You're the big guy with the big gun doing big damage on big bad guys. And I never really liked that side of computer games all that much. It can be cathartic. It can be cool to run around and shoot stuff. But most games are about, you know, you can be whoever you want to be. You can do whatever you want to do. You can save the world. You can save the princess that you mentioned before. And in this one, because you're a failure, because you're a has-been, and because the world, in a way, is a failure, it means that all the small triumphs are actually triumphs. You have these moments of grace. You have these epiphanies. Sometimes they're as small as finally finding the willpower to change the capital E expression on your face and look more like a regular human being that actually people want to interact with. Sometimes it might be something like a chat with a crypto entomologist who tells you about all these insects they're looking for that might not even exist, but you had a good chat and that's always a triumph, which is very different from, you know, defeating the dragon, killing the undead overlord. It's much more about these small human moments, these moments where you don't fail, and that's the triumph. It's an extremely imaginative game. Another reason why I picked it is it's very difficult to share games with people who are not that much into games because they're so full of their arcane rules. I speak fluent gamese because I grew up with them. But to someone else, to most of my family, if I sat them in front of a game, they would say, how do I jump? What do I do? And another game that I was thinking about doing, it would have simply been too much for the non-gamers listening to us because you have to kind of work with physics, you have to fly spaceships, and that's complicated stuff. In this game, you pick choices. You click on, do you want an angry asshole? Do you want to be someone who actually empathizes? It's more like a pick-your-own-adventure book. And in that respect, it's a game that I think would be playable for non-gamers. It's absolutely wonderful. It's weird. It's beautifully written. It's got great music. It's got an aesthetic that's completely unique in games. It's by a small independent studio who never ever did anything else before this. This is their first thing. Not many people can do this. It's, I think, a game to soak in, like a warm bath that's scented of whiskey, while you're slightly drunk and perhaps wistful. It's beautiful, and I want to basically share it with the two of you.
Oh, I'm intrigued. I have to say, initially I wanted to complain that there's by far not enough disco in there, but I retract my complaint.
Actually, where you wake up in this kind of dive, this hotel that even if you hadn't trashed it, it would already look pretty trashed. And they've got, of course, they have a bar and they've got a karaoke stage. And one of your quests, so to speak, in the game is that at some point you want to stand on that karaoke bar and sing. And I did. And it was glorious and it was horrible and it was beautiful.
Excellent. Wow.
That sounds very immersive. As you say, I'm not clearly not a sophisticate about games. But I do get the problem, as exactly as you say, where do I click? How do I roll the little car around? How do I make it do a salto? And then I always lose the game because I'm too busy doing the salto instead of actually trying to, you know, win the game. So this might be something for me because it's sort of simpler and it doesn't sort of, it's not so motoric. You don't have to have memory in your hands to be able to click all the buttons in the right order or at the right speed.
Yeah? Exactly.
I might try. Does it? Which platforms does it work on? I wanted to ask
you. At the moment, it's just on PC, but it will be coming out on PlayStation and Xbox, I think. I'm not 100% certain about the Xbox, but it is planned. But it is the kind of game that I think works best with a mouse and a keyboard, simply because you're going to be clicking on stuff, you're going to be walking around. You probably don't need a very fast PC. If you've got a PC that was bought during the last 5 years, I think it should run it. And it's definitely well worth playing. So, yeah, I hope I've made you slightly curious.
You did.
What about you? What did you bring us as a present?
I brought the movie. I didn't know this movie existed. It came out last year. It's called either Tea with the Dames or Nothing Like a Dame. And it's special because it's about four ladies, Dame Eileen Atkins, Dame Judi Dench, Dame Joan Plowright, and Dame Maggie Smith. They meet at Dame Joan's house regularly, and they talk and they talk and they talk, whatever comes to mind. It's just four friends meeting. And Roger Mitchell, the director of Notting Hill and My Cousin Rachel, for instance, he was pretty adamant asking whether he could film one of those afternoons. And initially they said, no dice. And eventually they said, yeah, okay, but just one afternoon. And he was allowed to film them just talking, drinking, sharing jokes and everything. And it's just a fantastic movie. I mean, those four ladies, they have more than 200 years of theater and movie background. It's not a glitzy documentary. That's exactly what it's not. There are inserts about a very young Judi Dench acting, Maggie Smith, Joan Plowright in a scene with her later husband, Laurence Olivier, things like that. But essentially, you see those four ladies talking to each other. There is the occasional prompt by Mitchell off screen, but essentially they just talk like the cameras weren't rolling, and that's just fascinating. They talk about things like Judi Dench tells Maggie Smith, "You remember when we met? It was in 1958. And Maggie Smith says, "No. Where was that?" "In Edinburgh." "Ah, I don't remember at all." And suddenly Judi Dench recites from a play. She doesn't know which play that is. And she says, "It must be 40 years old, but I can't remember what I had for breakfast, you know, yesterday," things like that. They talk about memory and memory loss and about getting their first roles and what their parents thought and acting alongside their respective husbands. It's fascinating. I mean, Maggie Smith is the prickly pear that she is in real life, even in this documentary. There's no makeup, there's no glitz. They just talk whatever they want. I mean, Judi Dench starts swearing and cursing at one point because she had a bad experience with an on-set medic when she was shooting the Best Marigold Hotel, something like that. Mm-hmm. Things like that. I mean, there are ups and downs. There are memories, good memories, bad memories. They break into song. They also debate whether it's easier for women to act, to get roles nowadays. And Eileen Atkins, for instance, it's a really rather painful confession she makes. She says, "I wanted to play Cleopatra, but I didn't think I was beautiful enough." Things like that. And Maggie Smith, instead of sort of consoling her, she says, "That's why I went to Canada for playing Cleopatra." It wasn't a statement about her looks. It was a statement about if she would fail as Cleopatra, at least she wouldn't fail at home in the UK, but in Canada. So she was pretty safe. It's not even a 90-minute movie. I'm not sure whether the award ceremony compilation at the end of the movie is anything in its favor. I could have done without that. Mm-hmm. But I was really, really intrigued listening to those four ladies, I have to say. They meet at Joan Plowright's house because Dame Joan is no longer very well on her feet. Her eyesight is failing. There is a joke about swapping hearing aids. So hearing is also a problem. What the movie also made me realize again is that Judi Dench, she's not that much a veteran of film. I mean, the first real success she had in film is 1997 with Her Majesty Mrs. Brown. She did movies before, but not she was not in any way hugely successful at all. And now she's M. You know, you can't think about James Bond without her. Wow.
That sounds amazing. It's actually, I've heard of it because I also found it this year and I got it for my sister for her for Christmas. She hasn't got it yet. If she listens to this podcast when it comes out, the surprise will be ruined. But I don't think my sister is one of our listeners.
All right.
But now I think I should also have gotten it for myself.
I thought I brought it along because I thought it was an antidote to all those best of lists. I have nothing against best of lists at all, but you don't just get the year's review, you know. So it's just, it's amazing. And I wanted to know what they had to say to each other privately, that you don't get that often and that concentrated in one movie.
That's so interesting. I hadn't heard of that yet, but I would sort of sit down with these ladies forever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They won't let me, but if I had the choice, I would very much like to sit down with them.
Yeah,
I
mean, absolutely.
It's their private congregation, and they even tease the on-set photographer, you know, haven't you made enough pictures now? Is this your first time? They tease him until he leaves.
I love that.
Yeah.
Probably 10, 15 years ago, I saw Judi Dench and Maggie Smith on stage. It wasn't a very good play. I don't even remember that play much other than they were in it. But the two of them, it's just that personality. I probably had a cheap seat back at the very back of the theater. And their personalities filled that space so much.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, it basically you just want to spend time with them. But it's also, I mean, I'm at an age now where there's these actors who have always been around. When I was a kid, they were already acting. As I've grown up, they've always been around. And they're now getting to an age where they get old, where they get ill. They might lose their hearing. They might lose their eyesight. They might get Alzheimer's and they die. And for me, because my family, basically my parents came from two different countries. I live in a third country. Family has, for me, always, in a strange way, I think, I've almost felt more familial connection to some of these actors who have always been around in the classics than to, let's say, my grandparents, who I saw once a year, perhaps. And in that way, it feels like we're now at an age where our grandparents, the Judi Denches and Michael Gambons, are getting old and getting on. It's kind of sad.
Yeah. In a way, I always thought Alan Rickman was slightly older than me and I would, you know, he would be around, and now he's just not.
Well, that's a great segue into my pick for you guys. I bought you one movie each.
Oh, nice. Wow.
Which is, it's okay. It's okay. They're related. They're related movies. And the segue is that when I decided on these movies, I looked on my Twitter and I saw that Danny Aiello had died. And he's one of the protagonists in one of the movies that I picked. And I was like, okay, this is sort of also a great excuse to talk about such an underrated, or not underrated, but oft forgotten actor. So the movies I picked, let me start with you, Matt. For you, it's a movie called Dinner Rush, which stars Danny Aiello. Mm-hmm. It was made in 2000. And when I decided on this movie, I could hardly get a hold of it. It's been forgotten. And I remember it from when I worked in the video store. And I really, it's a bit dated, maybe, but I really, really loved it. And I loved it because it's about food.
Oh, okay.
It was directed, yeah, and Christmas is food to me. So it was directed by Bob Giraldi, who apparently owns a restaurant. And what it does is it films in the kitchen like an actual kitchen would look like. It's a chaos. It's a din. It's just dreadful. These people misbehave in awful ways. And it gives this nice little, this buzz of a busy restaurant. The plot is not that important. There is one, right? But this movie, as well as the movie I picked for MAGA, which I'll get to a bit later, takes place over the course of one evening. And we get a food critic who shows up. We get an art critic who shows up. We get people who may or may not be mafia or ex-mafia who show up. And this entire sort of evening and the chaos in the kitchen, and someone has huge gambling debts and somebody is sleeping with just about everyone on the entire staff. To me, and I've worked in a kitchen, to me it felt real. It felt like an actual, not this really neat, sanitized, you get nice plates and it looks like a Gordon Ramsay show. No, this is just war, right?
Yeah.
And because I loved it so much, and because I could hardly find it, and because it's just nowhere on any list anywhere ever, and because it's Christmas and it has to be about food, this is my gift, my Christmas gift to you.
Oh, wonderful.
So I hope you will want to see it.
Oh, totally. It reminds me from what you've said of Big Night. You remember that one with, who is it, Tony Shalhoub and...
Stanley Tucci.
Stanley Tucci, exactly.
Yeah.
And Smoke. You remember Smoke?
Yeah, I do.
It sounds a bit like a mix of those two in terms of the vibe. It sounds very good. No, I definitely will want to check that one out. Thanks a lot.
Wow.
All right. Which brings me to my next film, which is actually Big Night. You're absolutely right. Spot on.
Wow.
Because when you're talking about food and film, you cannot miss Big Night. And of course, I'd seen it before. It's pretty old. It's from 1996. And I saw it again because I chose it as one of my food movies of the year. And it's so good. It's just amazing how good it is. Again, you're quite right. It's Campbell Scott and Stanley Tucci, and the two protagonists are Stanley Tucci and Tony Shalhoub. And for our listeners who may not have seen this, Tony Shalhoub is this brilliant genius chef who does not compromise on his food. And Stanley Tucci is trying to be kind of a businessman, but the restaurant is failing. Mm-hmm. It's just one of these purist things where you know, okay, the chef is probably right, but customers want spaghetti and meatballs, you know, or a steak. They don't want the perfect seafood risotto, which has no vongole in it, right? And this tension develops as Stanley Tucci goes for help at another restaurant whose owner is played by the great Ian Holm, who says, okay, look, I cannot lend you money, but I will get this great celebrity to visit your restaurant and the press will be all over it. It will be wonderful. It will be great for business. So that one evening is basically the film. Again, this is a film which plays out over the course, mostly over the course of one evening. And the preparations, we have lovely side characters. We have the lady in the flower shop. We have, I think, a priest. We have the guy who delivers really sort of sad bunches of herbs to which Tony Shalhoub objects. So all these little side characters. And there's the big meal. And there are even chapter headings in between courses. They have like this wonderful traditional Italian food. But lots and lots and lots of wine. Lots and lots of wine. And everybody gets really tiddly and slightly ridiculous and a little bit emotional. And again, there is a plot to this movie, but the plot is not the point.
Mm-hmm.
And what stuck with me after all these years was the ending. The last scene is maybe the perfect scene in any film about food ever, right? This is the perfect food scene. So that's what I brought you, Maga.
Great. Thanks a lot. Wow. When you mentioned Danny Aiello before, I thought you were going to talk about Do the Right Thing or something. But
isn't he also in Hudson Hawk?
Yeah. Talk about your underrated movies.
Yeah.
No, so those are my two. There, of course, are a lot of films about food, and I'm sort of obsessed with food in film. I almost did Goodfellas just to talk about the food in Goodfellas. Because it's very prominent, or something like Jiro Dreams of Sushi, which is a wonderful little documentary about sushi and its art and also its people. But I ended up in American Italian country for Christmas for this year. Maybe next year we'll do Japanese.
Very nice. Thank you. It's like you knew, Julie, that I earned my first three semesters of university by doing the dishes in a kitchen. So I know about the agony and the ecstasy, you know, backstage in the kitchen cooking. And I never cooked.
Oh, yeah.
I don't have that. I'm not a trained chef or anything. I just did the dishes from 6 o'clock until very, very early. in the morning. I failed two courses because I was so tired all the time. But I watched a renowned cook do his thing and the apprentice doing the salads and sauces and everything. So, yeah, I did that for more than a year. So kitchens mean insomnia, but also some kind of magic that something is happening back there. So it's I think Big Night is a great choice. Thanks a lot for that.
Yeah, I did prep in a kitchen. And I've sort of been drawn to the subject ever since.
Yeah.
The hours are rotten, the pay is rotten, the burns and the cuts are rotten, and I don't know why I loved it so much.
Will you be doing any big cooking over Christmas yourself, Julie?
I wanted to, and I used to do a lot of cooking. But nowadays, I don't know. It's just the two of us. My parents don't really want to come over anymore when it's dark. Mm-hmm. My mom doesn't really want to drive on the freeway anymore. So no big Christmas dinners. I do one, so for just the two of us. So I have this enormous, impossibly unsustainable sized steak. It's sustainably sourced. I mean, it's biological and it's free range, but it's really large. but it's sadly because I do miss Christmas dinners. And even when I worked in the kitchen, I never understood why people would eat out at Christmas. Mm. I'd always try to cook at home. How about you guys? Are you any big food plans?
I will definitely be cooking for my wife's family on the 24th. It's not going to be big. On the 25th, it's my sister will be doing the traditional Christmas turkey. It was always my mother till she died 10 years ago. And from what you said, actually, 10 years ago after my mother died, that was the first and only year when we went to a restaurant for Christmas. We just said, we're going to go back to the turkey tradition at some point, but we need a timeout. So we went to a restaurant. It was right in that situation, but I agree. I like Christmas dinners at home with friends and family. It doesn't even have to be on the 24th, 25th. Just, yeah, Christmas and food go together. That's my religion.
Mm-hmm.
They do. They do.
On the 24th, my mom is on the 25th my mom is going to cook something, and I tried to suggest that, you know, she shouldn't do that every year because she was exhausted every time she did that, and I tried to suggest that somebody else cook, and that was, I almost sparked a revolution. It's not, you can't do that, you know, the 25th it's just hers. You can't take that away. You break with the tradition, and we don't, apparently it's not done in our family. So the 24th is with my partner's family. It's a very much bigger crowd than my people. And it's her sister cooking, basically. Some of the years I cook for New Year's Eve, but this year my partner has said she's going to volunteer, so she's going to do it. I don't have to cook anything this year. Yay. It's not a chore or anything, but I'm sort of enjoying that I don't have to cook, but just enjoy and eat and drink, and that's it.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Okay, to round up, we're looking towards next year, which is always the thing with the end of the season, New Year's coming up. So I was just wondering, what are you looking forward to movie-wise, game-wise, book-wise, audiobook-wise, podcast-wise, I don't care. What are you looking forward to right now as you are for the big 2020?
Knives out.
Yay.
I'm talking about the film, not actually Christmas dinner.
That's the Ryan Johnson detective story, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, murder mystery, yeah.
Maga?
Yeah, I'm looking for the title. Oh, there is that there's that Killing Eve style. I don't even know whether it's a series or a movie. It's with I think it's with Carrie Mulligan having her revenge on a couple of mostly men.
Promising young woman,
thanks. That's what I'm looking forward to. Because if it's anything like Killing Eve or Fleabag, then yeah, I'm in.
How about you, Julie?
Also Knives Out.
Knives Out here as well. I'm sort of more abstract because we've been so spoiled this year with these lovely Lost Leader television shows. It's really great. Wonderful. I'm just going to take three subscriptions out on streaming services: The Watchmen, The Mandalorian, His Dark Materials, which was also that's quite good.
Okay,
actually, and better than the movie, which was sort of really, I don't know. I'm sort of in the abstract looking forward to what they're going to feed us next to get our money. Because if it's half as good,
yeah.
if it's half as good as any of those, I will have a very, very happy year next year and lots of stuff to watch. So yeah, I'm hoping that continues that trend. Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like we will all be very busy with all our various warm, steaming cups of culture. I'm looking forward to it. I'm also very much looking forward to having more chats, reading more blog posts, sharing culture with you guys. It's been fun. Thank you very much.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, thank you for 1919 and all the fun we did have. This was the Christmas episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. I wish you the best, happiest of holidays, and a really great transition into 2020. So our listeners, thank you for sticking with us all year. Matt, thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you.
And Maga, you too.
Yeah, thank you, Julie. Cheers.
And we'll see you next year. Bye-bye.
Till then, bye.
Merry Christmas. Bye-bye.